You are tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic for tonight's show is, do animals think like us? I'm going to focus a little bit on dogs, because they, more than any other animal, tend to live with us and be closest to us, and we tend to anthropomorphize their actions more than other animals, except for monkeys, apes, etc. So, do dogs think like us? Well, the answer seems to be yes, but only to a degree. According to an article in Discover magazine, a dog has the emotions of a 2 or 2.5 year old. So, that means some emotions, but not all. And unlike that 2.5 year old human who will grow into a middle-aged adult, dogs tend to reach the heights of their emotional range by about 6 months of age, and that's it. So the emotions a dog does have include love. They have the same oxytocin hormone that humans do, which is the hormone involved with love and affection. They experience joy and fear and anger and disgust and excitement and contentment and distress. What they don't feel is things like pride, contempt, shame, and guilt. We might think that they experience guilt if they've pooped in the living room and you find it on the floor and you see them slinking around. But really why they're slinking around is because they're fearful. They know that you're going to scream at them. One thing I think I can safely say about dogs, and this is just coming from me, is that they have no aesthetic sense like us. If you've ever tried pointing out a beautiful sunset to your dog, which I have in a moody mood, they are oblivious to it. They don't quite know what you are going on about. And though we think they react to television, dogs aren't terribly visual. Although I have to say mine does seem to perk up in the car when something unusual is happening on a sidewalk. Some man shuffling along who doesn't look like most people do will attract her attention. She's also always on the lookout for food, and it's not so much smell that guides her because she'll go chasing after a leaf that looks like a piece of meat. She also recognises when we are approaching the breakfast place I go to where they give her treats. She'll start jumping up and down, hoping that we'll stop. But things like animals on television, dogs on television, dogs barking on television even, she will not react to. And I think that's fairly common. Although I know some pets do react to television, specific things. A friend of mine's cat would love to watch ice skating on television. If that was on, she would be glued to the set. But actually, most of them just see patterns of light in terms of the flicker rates on TV. Some of the high-resolution digital screens, though, do have a higher flicker rate. So sometimes your pet can get interested in a nature show if it's got a really high-resolution digital image. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. My topic tonight is, do animals think like us and or react as we do to certain things? They certainly do seem to dream, don't they? They can yelp and move their legs in their sleep, which indicates the same kind of electrical activity that occurs in humans. There's evidence that quite a few animals dream. Rats, for instance. Studies of electrical recordings of the rat hippocampus, that part of the brain associated with memory, formation and storage, have indicated that if a rat makes its way through a maze during its waking state, it quite possibly tries the same thing in its sleep later on. The electrical patterns seem to match, and research does indicate that these animals, rats and dogs, mimic the activities they perform during the day, during their dreams. Here's a funny factoid, Ray. Dogs and dreams that scientists seem to have legitimized. Small dogs have more dreams than big dogs. A toy poodle, for instance, dreams once every 10 minutes, whereas a Great Dane or a Mastiff seems to dream only once every hour. But the big dog's dreams are bigger dreams, because it seems they last longer. You're tuned to The Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about do animals think like us? And since we don't live with that many animals, mainly cats and dogs, I'm focusing a little more on dogs because cats give very little away. Dogs seem to smile at us when we smile at them, or when they're happy, or when we're happy, right? Mine certainly does. Mine has a permanent smile on her face, pretty much. What's really happening is that when a dog is relaxed, it opens its jaws slightly and lets its tongue lap out over its front teeth. So that sort of looks like a smile. If something happens that makes it anxious, the dog closes its mouth and you can no longer see the tongue or a simulation of a smile. But they also laugh, dogs do. When they open their mouth and their tongue hangs out and they start to slightly pant, that's their version of laughing. An animal behaviorist called Patricia Simonette analyzed the recordings of these dog pantings, and they're different from other dog pantings. When they're running around, playing and having fun and laughing, there's a different frequency to the panting, apparently. She played the recording she'd made of them laughing back to them, and it made them laugh more. It also helped calm dogs that were housed in an animal shelter. Aww. You are tuned to The Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is, do animals think like us and or react like us? Here's what conservationist and writer Carl Safina had to say in his TED Talk.
There are capacities of the human mind that we tend to think are capacities only of the human mind. But is that true? What are other beings doing with those brains? What are they thinking and feeling? Is there a way to know? I think there is a way in. I think there are several ways in. We can look at evolution. We can look at their brains. And we can watch what they do. First thing to remember is our brain is inherited. The first neurons came from jellyfish. Jellyfish gave rise to the first chordates. The first chordates gave rise to the first vertebrates. The vertebrates came out of the sea, and here we are. But it's still true that a neuron, a nerve cell, looks the same in a crayfish, a bird, or you. What does that say about the minds of crayfish? Can we tell anything about that? Well, it turns out that if you give a crayfish a lot of little tiny electric shocks every time it tries to come out of its burrow, it will develop anxiety. If you give the crayfish the same drug used to treat anxiety disorder in humans, it relaxes and comes out and explores. How do we show how much we care about crayfish anxiety? Mostly we boil them. Octopuses use tools as well as do most apes, and they recognize human faces. If a grouper chases a fish into a crevice in the coral, it will sometimes go to where it knows a moray eel is sleeping, and it will signal to the moray, "Follow me," and the moray will understand that signal. The moray may go into the crevice and get the fish, but the fish may bolt and the grouper may get it. This is an ancient partnership that we have just recently found out about. Sea otters use tools, and they take time away from what they're doing to show their babies what to do, which is called teaching. Killer whales teach, and killer whales share food. When evolution makes something new, it uses the parts it has in stock, off the shelf, before it fabricates a new twist. And our brain has come to us through the enormity of the deep sweep of time. If you look at the human brain compared to a chimpanzee brain, what you see is we have basically a very big chimpanzee brain. It's a good thing ours is bigger because we're also really insecure. Okay, brains, but what does that have to say about minds? Well, we can see the working of the mind in the logic of behaviors.
And many of those behavioral traits span the entire animal kingdom, including Homo sapiens. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. And that's my topic tonight, exploring whether animals think like us, humans. And we're listening to a TED Talk by conservationist and author Carl Safina, talking about certain similarities in animal behaviors. He shows this slide of elephants in the wild.
These elephants have found a patch of shade under the palm trees, under which to let their babies sleep while they doze but remain vigilant. We make perfect sense of that image just as they make perfect sense of what they're doing. Because under the arc of the same sun, on the same plains, listening to the howls of the same dangers, they became who they are and we became who we are. These elephants are obviously very concerned about something. What are they concerned about? It turns out that if you record the voices of tourists and you play that recording from a speaker hidden in bushes, elephants will ignore it because tourists never bother elephants. But if you record the voices of herders who carry spears and often hurt elephants in confrontations at waterholes, the elephants will bunch up and run away from the hidden speaker. Not only do elephants know that there are humans, they know that there are different kinds of humans and that some are okay and some are dangerous. They have been watching us for much longer than we have been watching them. They know us better than we know them. We have the same imperatives. Take care of our babies, find food, try to stay alive. Whether we're outfitted for hiking in the hills of Africa or outfitted for diving under the sea, we are basically the same. We are kin under the skin. The elephant has the same skeleton. The killer whale has the same skeleton, as do we. We see helping where help is needed. We see curiosity in the young. We see the bonds of family connections. We recognize affection. Courtship is courtship. And then we ask, are they conscious? Consciousness is simply the thing that feels like something. If you see, if you hear, if you feel, if you're aware of anything, you are conscious, and they are conscious. Some people say, well, there are certain things that make humans humans, and one of those things is empathy. Empathy is the mind's ability to match moods with your companions. It's a very useful thing. If your companions start to move quickly, you have to feel like you need to hurry up. We're all in a hurry now. The oldest form of empathy is contagious fear. If your companions suddenly startle and fly away, it does not work very well for you to say, geez, I wonder why everybody just left. But empathy, like everything else in life, comes on a sliding scale and has its elaboration. So there's basic empathy. You feel sad, it makes me sad. I see you happy, it makes me happy. Then there's something that I call sympathy, a little more removed. I'm sorry to hear that your grandmother has just passed away. I don't feel that same grief, but I get it. I know what you feel, and it concerns me. And then if we're motivated to act on sympathy, I call that compassion. Far from being the thing that makes us human, human empathy is far from perfect. We round up empathic creatures, we kill them, and we eat them. Now, maybe you say, okay, well, those are different species. That's just predation, and humans are predators. But we don't treat our own kind too well either.
You're mean to me. Why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me cry. I'm left all alone. singing the blues and sighing. You treat me coldly each day in the year. You always scold me whenever somebody is near. Dear, it must be great fun to be mean to me. You shouldn't forget. You need to be.
Listening to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, exploring tonight whether animals think like us. Conservationist and writer Carl Safina has strong opinions on the subject.
People who seem to know only one thing about animal behavior know that you must never attribute human thoughts and emotions to other species. Well, I think that's silly, because attributing human thoughts and emotions to other species is the best first guess about what they're doing and how they're feeling. Because their brains are basically the same as ours. They have the same structures, the same hormones that create mood and motivation in us are in those brains as well. It is not scientific to say that they are hungry when they're hunting and they're tired when their tongues are hanging out, and then say, when they're playing with their children and acting joyful and happy, we have no idea if they can possibly be experiencing anything. That is not scientific. So, okay, so a reporter said to me, but how do you really know that other animals can think and feel? And I started to rifle through all the hundreds of scientific references, and I realized that the answer was right in the room with me. When my dog gets off the rug and comes over to me, not to the couch, to me, and she rolls over on her back and exposes her belly, she has had the thought, I would like my belly rubbed. She has thought, I know he will understand what I'm asking. I know I can trust him because we're family. He'll get the job done and it will feel good. And it's really not more complicated than that. But we see other animals and we say, oh, look, elephants, wolves. That's not how they see it. In Yellowstone National Park, we killed every single wolf. We killed every single wolf south of the Canadian border, actually. But in the park, park rangers did that in the 1920s. And then 60 years later, they had to bring them back because the elk numbers had gotten out of control. And then people came by the thousands to see the wolves, the most accessibly visible wolves in the world. And I went there and I watched this incredible family of wolves. A pack is a family. It has some breeding adults and the young of several generations. And I watched the most famous, most stable pack in Yellowstone National Park. And then when they wandered just outside the border, two of their adults were killed, including the mother, which we sometimes call the alpha female. The rest of the family immediately descended into sibling rivalry. Sisters kicked out other sisters. One tried for days to rejoin her family. They wouldn't let her because they were jealous of her. She was getting too much attention from two new males, and she was the precocious one. That was too much for them. She wound up wandering outside the park and getting shot. The alpha male wound up being ejected from his own family. As winter was coming in, he lost his territory, his hunting support, the members of his family, and his mate. We cause so much pain to them. The mystery is, why don't they hurt us more than they do?
times, but don't you know we're stronger now? My heart still beats and my skin still feels, my lungs still breathe, my mind still feels, but we're running out of time. The echoes in my mind cry, there's blood on your lies, the skies up and wide, there is nowhere for you to hide, the hottest moon is shining. I'm on you with the wolves tonight, I'm on you with the wolves, I'm on you with the wolves tonight, I'm on you with the wolves, I'm on you with the trick or treat, what would it be? I walk alone, I'm everything. My ears can hear and my mouth can speak, my spirit talks, I know my soul believes, but we're running out of time. All the echoes in my mind.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is, do animals think like us? Conservationist and author Carl Safina is convinced they do, and often even more empathically.
Why is it that killer whales have returned to researchers lost in thick fog and led them miles until the fog parted and the researcher's home was right there on the shoreline? And that's happened more than one time. In the Bahamas, there's a woman named Denise Herzing, and she studies spotted dolphins, and they know her. She knows them very well. She knows who they all are. They know her. They recognize the research boat. When she shows up, it's a big, happy reunion. Except one time she showed up, and they didn't want to come near the boat. And that was really strange. And they couldn't figure out what was going on until somebody came out on deck and announced that one of the people on board had died during a nap in his bunk. How could dolphins know that one of the human hearts had just stopped? Why would they care? And why would it spook them? These mysterious things just hint at all of the things that are going on in the minds that are with us on Earth that we almost never think about at all. In an aquarium in South Africa was a little baby bottlenose dolphin named Dolly. She was nursing, and one day a keeper took a cigarette break, and he was looking into the window into their pool, smoking. Dolly came over and looked at him, went back to her mother, nursed for a minute or two, came back to the window, and released a cloud of milk that enveloped her head like smoke. Somehow, this baby bottlenose dolphin got the idea of using milk to represent smoke. When human beings use one thing to represent another, we call that art.
One breath away from Mother Oceania. Your nimble feet make prints in my sand. You have done good for
to the Sharana on Laguna's one and only FM listener-supported, member-supported public radio station, KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is, do animals think like us humans? We're currently hearing conservationist and author Carl Safina's thoughts on the matter.
The things that make us human are not the things that we think make us human. What makes us human is that of all these things that our minds and their minds have, we are the most extreme. We are the most compassionate, most violent, most creative, and most destructive animal that has ever been on this planet. And we are all of those things all jumbled up together. But love is not the thing that makes us human. It's not special to us. We're not the only ones who care about our mates. We're not the only ones who care about our children. Albatrosses nest on the most remote islands in the oceans of the world. They frequently fly sometimes 10,000 miles over several weeks to deliver one meal, one big meal, to their chick who is waiting for them. Passing life from one generation to the next is the chain of being. If anything is sacred, that is. If that stops, it all goes away. And into that sacred relationship comes our plastic trash. All of these birds have plastic in them now. This is not the relationship we are supposed to have with the rest of the world. But we who have named ourselves after our brains never think about the consequences. When we welcome new human life into the world, we welcome our babies into the company of other creatures. We paint animals on the walls. We don't paint cell phones. We paint animals to show them that we are not alone. We have company. And every one of those animals, in every painting of Noah's Ark, deemed worthy of salvation, is in mortal danger now. And their flood is us.
Summer follows fast. Make hay while it lasts. Don't ever dwell upon the past. For one day about is all the dogs and the horses you'll have to outlive. They'll be with you when you say
My, that was a bit dramatic, wasn't it? But what would we do without a world full of animals? Can you imagine not having animals in this world? I think it would be a seriously inferior place, wouldn't it? We bond with most animals, at least the cute ones, but we don't really know what they're thinking, do we? We're told not to anthropomorphize them, but there is a lot of indication that they do think like us. That exploration is the topic of my share now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Frans de Waal is a Dutch primatologist and ethologist who's explored moral behavior in the animal kingdom.
As a student, I went to a zoological garden where we keep chimpanzees, and I discovered there that chimpanzees are very power hungry. And at that time, the focus in a lot of animal research was on aggression and competition, and actually the whole picture of the animal kingdom, and humanity included, was that deep down we are competitors, we are aggressive, we are all out for our own profit, basically. Now, in the process of doing all this work on power and dominance and aggression and so on, I discovered that chimpanzees reconcile after fights.
Frans de Waal holds up a picture of two chimps in a tree.
Here is two males who have had a fight. They ended up in a tree, and one of them holds out a hand to the other. And about a second after I took the picture, they came together in the fork of the tree and they kissed and embraced each other. Now, this is very interesting because at the time, everything was about competition and aggression, and so it wouldn't make any sense. The only thing that matters is that you win or that you lose. But why would you reconcile after a fight? That doesn't make any sense. Bonobos do it. Bonobos do everything with sex, and so they also reconcile with sex. But the principle is exactly the same. The principle is that you have a valuable relationship that is damaged by conflict, so you need to do something about it. And so my whole picture of the animal kingdom, and including humans also, started to change at that time. So we have this image in political science, economics, the humanities, philosophy for that matter, that man is a wolf to man. And so deep down, our nature is actually nasty. I think it's a very unfair image for the wolf. The wolf is after all, a very cooperative animal. And that's why many of you have a dog at home, which has all these characteristics also. And it's very unfair to humanity, because humanity is actually much more cooperative and empathic than they're given credit for. And so I started getting interested in those issues and studying that in other animals.
So morality became the focus of primatologist and ethologist Frans de Waal's explorations into whether animals are like us or not. That's the topic of my share now tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935.
If you ask anyone what is morality based on, these are the two factors that always come out. One is reciprocity, and associated with it is a sense of justice and a sense of fairness. And the other one is empathy and compassion. And human morality is more than this, but if you would remove these two pillars, there would be not much remaining, I think. And so they're absolutely essential. So this is already about 100 years ago that we were doing experiments on cooperation, where they trained chimpanzees to cooperate.
Frans de Waal holds up another picture of two chimps.
What you have here is two young chimpanzees who have a box, and the box is too heavy for one chimp to pull in, and so they're bringing in the box. And of course, there's food on the box, otherwise they wouldn't be pulling so hard. They work together, they pull at the same moment. It's already a big advance over many other animals who wouldn't be able to do that. And now you're going to get a more interesting picture, because now one of the two chimps has been fed. So one of the two is not really interested in the task anymore. So there are two interesting parts about this. One is that the chimp on the right...
The chimp on the right is the hungry one who hasn't yet been fed.
The chimp on the right has a full understanding he needs the partner. So full understanding of the need for cooperation. The second one is that the partner is willing to work even though he's not interested in the food. Why would that be? Well, that probably has to do with reciprocity. There's actually a lot of evidence in primates and other animals that they return favors. And so he will get a return favor at some point in the future. And so that's how this all operates. We do the same task with elephants. Now, with elephants, it's very dangerous to work with elephants. And another problem with elephants is that you cannot make an apparatus that is too heavy for a single elephant. Now, you can probably make it, but it's going to be a pretty clumsy apparatus, I think. And so what we did in their case is we have an apparatus around of which there's a rope, a single rope. And if you pull on this side of the rope disappears on the other side. So two elephants need to pick it up at exactly the same time and pull. Otherwise, nothing is going to happen. And so the two elephants who are released together arrive at the apparatus has food on it. And so they come together, they arrive together, They pick it up together, and they pull together. So it's actually fairly simple for them. That's how they bring it in. But now we're going to make it more difficult, because the whole purpose of this experiment is to see how well they understand cooperation. Do they understand it as well as the chimps, for example? And so what we do in the next step is we release one elephant before the other, and that elephant needs to be smart enough to stay there and wait and not pull at the rope, because if he pulls at the rope, it disappears and the whole test is over. Now, this elephant does something illegal that we did not teach it, but it shows the understanding that he has, because he puts his big foot on the rope, stands on the rope, and waits there for the other, and then the other is going to do all the work for him. It's what we call freeloading. But it shows the intelligence that the elephants had. They developed several of these alternative techniques that we did not approve of necessarily. This was the cooperation reciprocity part. Now something on empathy. Empathy is my main topic at the moment of research, and empathy has sort of two qualities. One is the understanding part of it, the ability to understand and share the feelings of another, and the emotional part. And so empathy has basically two channels. One is the body channel. If you talk with a sad person, you're going to adopt a sad expression and a sad posture. And before you know it, you feel sad. And that's sort of the body channel of emotional empathy, which many animals have. Your average dog has that also. That's actually why people keep mammals in the home and not turtles or snakes or something like that, who don't have that kind of empathy. And then there's a cognitive channel, which is more that you can take the perspective of somebody else. And that's more limited. There's few animals. I think elephants and apes can do that kind of thing, but there are very few animals who can do that. Humans yawn when others yawn. And synchronization, which is part of that whole empathy mechanism, is a very old one in the animal kingdom. It's related to empathy. It activates the same areas in the brain. Also, we know that people who have a lot of yawn contagion are highly empathic. People who have problems with empathy, such as autistic children, they don't have yawn contagion. So it is connected. And so yawn contagion is something that we share with other animals. And that's related to that whole body channel of synchronization that underlies empathy. And that is universal in the mammals, basically. Now, we also study more complex expressions, consolation.
Frans de Waal holds up another picture of two chimps.
This is a male chimpanzee who has lost a fight, and he's screaming, and a juvenile comes over and puts an arm around him and calms him down. That's consolation. It's very similar to human consolation. It's empathy-driven. That's actually the way they study empathy in human children, is to instruct a family member to act distressed, and then they see what young children do. We also recently published an experiment, you may have heard about it, on altruism in chimpanzees, where the question is, do chimpanzees care about the welfare of somebody else? And for decades, it had been assumed that only humans can do that. Only humans worry about the welfare of somebody else. Now, we did a very simple experiment. We put two chimpanzees side by side, and one has a bucket full of tokens, and the tokens have different meanings. One kind of token feeds only the partner who chooses. The other one feeds both of them. So they have a whole bucket full of two-color tokens, and they have to pick one of the two colors. So if this chimp makes the selfish choice, only the one gets food. So the one who makes the choices, that's the interesting part, the one who makes the choices always get a reward. So it doesn't matter whatsoever, and she should actually be choosing blindly. But what we find is that they prefer the pro-social token. And if the partner puts pressure on them, if the partner starts spitting water and intimidating them, then the choices go down and they actually don't want to. It's as if they're saying, if you're not behaving, I'm not going to be pro-social today. And so we found that the chimpanzees do care about the well-being of somebody else, especially other members of their own group.
You're listening to part of a TED Talk by primatologist and ethologist Frans de Waal on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour, with me, Sharon James, examining tonight whether animals think and or react like us humans. Frans de Waal's focus is on moral behaviour in animals and what form that takes, particularly in the primate family.
A final experiment that I want to mention is our fairness study. This became a very famous study, and there's now many more, because after we did this about 10 years ago, it became very well known. And we did that originally with capuchin monkeys. It has now been done with dogs and with birds and with chimpanzees, but it started out with capuchin monkeys. So what we did is we put two capuchin monkeys side by side. Again, these animals, they live in a group. They know each other. We take them out of the group, put them in a test chamber. And there's a very simple task that they need to do. And if you give both of them cucumber for the task, the two monkeys side by side, they're perfectly willing to do this 25 times in a row. So cucumber, even though it's really only water in my opinion, is perfectly fine for them. Now, if you give the partner grapes, the food preferences of my capuchin monkeys correspond exactly with the prices in the supermarket. So if you give them grapes, it's a far better food, then you create inequity between them. So that's the experiment we did. Recently, we videotaped it with new monkeys who had never done the task, thinking that maybe they would have a stronger reaction, and that turned out to be right.
It's a shame this is an audio-only medium, because it's quite funny to watch this video that Frans de Waal shows in this talk of the one monkey receiving the cucumber and the other receiving the grape. But hopefully this description will conjure up the image.
So she gives a rock to us, that's the task, and we give her a piece of cucumber and she eats it. Note that the first piece of cucumber is perfectly fine, the first piece she eats, and then she sees the other one getting grapes. The other one needs to give a rock to us, and she does, and she gets a grape, and she eats it. The other one sees that, she gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber.
They're laughing because the monkey throws the cucumber back at the trainers.
She tests the rock now against the wall. She needs to give it to us. And she gets cucumber again.
The monkey's beside herself, smashing at the walls of the cage.
So this is basically the Wall Street protest that you see here. Let me tell you a funny story about this. This study became very famous, and we got a lot of comments, especially anthropologists, economists, philosophers. They didn't like this at all, because they had decided in their mind, I believe, that fairness is a very complex issue and that animals cannot have it. And so one philosopher even wrote us that it was impossible that monkeys had a sense of fairness, because fairness was invented during the French Revolution. And another one wrote a whole chapter saying that he would believe it had something to do with fairness if the one who got grapes would refuse the grapes. Now, the funny thing is that Sarah Brosnan, who's been doing this with chimpanzees, had a couple of combinations of chimpanzees where, indeed, the one who would get the grape would refuse the grape until the other guy also got a grape. So we're getting very close to the human sense of fairness, and I think philosophers need to rethink their philosophy for a while. I believe there's an evolved morality. I think morality is much more than what I've been talking about, but it would be impossible without these ingredients that we find in other primates, which are empathy and consolation, pro-social tendencies, and reciprocity and a sense of fairness.
So we're always taught not to anthropomorphize, let's say, the lesser animals, but studies like Frans de Waal's should make us re-examine that. You're tuned to The Sharer Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my topic tonight is, do animals think like us and react like us humans? And there's evidence from certainly some of these studies that maybe they do. Moral outrage, for instance, exists amongst them, as we've learnt with the monkeys and the cucumber and the grape. But then there are things that patently they don't seem to share. A sense of discretion. I mean, they can sit in front of us when we're eating and be licking their private parts, and they don't think anything of it, really, unless we point it out to them. And even then they look a bit confused, unsure what they were doing wrong. There's a rather funny article in The Times where a guy talks about his experiences doing the naughty with a girl who's used to having her dog sleeping on the bed. Ryan Pfeffer, the man in question, tells of a recent experience with a Chihuahua Pomeranian mix who was a bit of an emotional wreck, perhaps because she was left alone for long periods of time, but she would yap incessantly and only stop when someone petted her. He said she wasn't mean or snobbish, like some dogs are, just in a constant fight for the attention of her owner, so that the first time he and the dog's owner slept together, she wouldn't stop barking, the dog, that is, until the owner reached down and plucked her up and sat her on the bed. He said, strangely, she did actually become a little bit uncomfortable, peeking up over a pillow every few minutes until the deed was done. But he said, it wasn't incredibly comfortable knowing that she was there watching. He said, even though it was preferable to the yapping that happened when she was left on the floor. He said, once, by mistake, he accidentally kicked her off and then peered over the mattress to see this poor little nose and two tiny paws falling out of sight. He said he was kind of relieved when that relationship ended.
Thank you.
are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is, do animals think like us and or react like us? And I'm currently telling a story published in the Times by one Ryan Pfeffer about his dating misadventures with a couple of female dog owners. After the one with the Chihuahua didn't work out, he then met
another woman with a different kind of a dog. This dog was also part Chihuahua, but less emotionally hung up. He was a good boy and he knew it. His strut had bounce. He apparently accompanied them on almost every outing, and Ryan Pfeffer didn't mind a bit, he said. On a trip to the beach, he would guard their towels and then snuggle up to him afterwards, all sandy and warm. It was only once he took his owner to bed that the dog, called Rigatoni, changed. He would sit there on the foot of the bed looking as if he wanted to punch Ryan in the nose. He would never bite, but he did try to grab Ryan with his little T-Rex arms and wrestle him away from his master. She would shout at him, saying, "You're making everyone uncomfortable." And he said you could see the conflict on the poor dog's face, trying to be obedient, but also trying to protect. Ryan said only after a while did he learn that a meat-flavored bone could keep him occupied for the necessary 20 minutes.
"It's him or me, that's what he said. But I can't choose between a vegan and a pothead. So I chose you because you're sweet. And you give me lots of loving and you eat meat.
Tune to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight has been, do animals think like us? And from the scientific research, we seem to have learnt that some do, to some extent, but not quite to the degree of complexity, and others can think in ways that we humans can't. Dolphins, for instance, can put one side of the brain to sleep as they swim.
while the other side remains awake and alert. And they can switch. They can put the other side of the brain to sleep the one that was awake before and wake up the sleeping side. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? We can't do that. But it's a fun party trick, isn't it? Pond snails actually have brains that are similar to our brains, believe it or not. And they have something peculiar to them in that they can overcome warnings from their senses about what to eat if they're hungry enough. If they're starving, they'll eat anything, even stuff that is harmful that they would normally reject. Sounds a little like us, doesn't it? And they're just snails. The green-haired turtle, an Australian species that split from other living species about 40 million years ago, can breathe through its genitals, something we can't do. So I wonder what thoughts they have when they're doing that. Anyway, that about concludes my share in hour for tonight. If you'd like to hear this show again, you can do so on iTunes or go to our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharin-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. And do tune in again next week for more topics, conversations, interviews and such. Make a point of switching your dial to KX935 when you're in Laguna. We also have emergency updates and alerts. And even though you may have Alert OC or Nixie on your phone, sometimes our signals work where cell phone ones don't. Besides, it's nice to be tuned in to local stuff and to support this exclusively local FM radio station, started 6 years ago by Tyler Russell of Laguna Beach. I'm Sharon James. I'm wishing you a great, productive week ahead. And please come back and listen again Monday nights at 9:00.